Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archives.
Radio Netherlands.
Hope from the South, a Media Network historical documentary compiled by Jonathan Marks and Diana Janssen.
Hello and welcome to a special Media Network, looking back more than forward this time, as part of a special week of commemorative programs here on Radio Netherlands. May the 4th is Remembrance Day in the Netherlands, and tomorrow, May the 5th, is the day we celebrate this country's liberation from Nazi occupation in 1945. For provinces in the south of the country, liberation actually came earlier as the Allies advanced over the rivers Rhine and Maas. But the 5th was the day that the entire country was free. Of course, this year, being the 50th anniversary, a lot of special events are being organized. There's a special feeling in the air, no matter how old you are. Last week, I was seeing friends off at Schiphol Amsterdam Airport and saw Canadian, British and American war veterans arriving. The emotion in their eyes as they were met by old friends is something that makes the past so real. It also makes renewed intense hostilities in former Yugoslavia at the start of this week all the more tragic, at the time when we're looking back on the outbreak of peace. At a time when there was no television and only limited newspaper circulation, radio played a very important role in the rebuilding of the Netherlands. In the first part of today's program, we take a look at a station that started in Eindhoven to reach the occupied north and gradually developed into Holland's external broadcasting service, now known as Radio Netherlands.
We're fortunate in Holland that a group of concerned broadcasters started the Netherlands Broadcasting Museum in Hilversum back in the 1980s. Since then, the collection's grown from a few rooms in a villa to a proper exhibition centre, which draws thousands of visitors each year. The library contains books about broadcasting from authors in different parts of Europe, and the ability to compare what German, Dutch and English writers have to say about broadcasting during and just after the Second World War is in fact quite unique. A few weeks ago we made a programme from the museum as part of a special exhibition looking at the role of radio in the Netherlands from the German invasion on May 10, 1940 to liberation by May 5, 1945. That programme brought in a lot of response, with requests for us to dig a little deeper. For there are many contradictory reports in the traditional textbooks.
This is station PCJ of Philips Radio broadcasting on 31 metres, our weekly Friday programme, which only lasts for 60 minutes.
Before the war, Eddie Stouts was running regular multilingual programmes over the Philips station in Eindhoven, PCJJ, which he shortened to simply PCJ, standing for Peace, Cheer and Joy. In 1938, a more powerful transmitter site was constructed in Huizen, just north of Hilversum. The antenna was a unique wooden construction on a turntable, which allowed PCJ to beam in any direction that was desired. Many accounts say that when the Germans invaded in May 1940, the antenna was destroyed by the Dutch and external broadcasting was suspended. Well, in a sense it was. The Dutch government went into exile in London and broadcast back to the Netherlands using airtime granted to them by the BBC. Meanwhile, here in Hilversum, the Germans combined all the various broadcasting societies into a national broadcasting organisation and censored the output. It appears, though, that Dutch broadcasters like the Catholic KRO did transmit programmes in Dutch on shortwave to listeners in what is now Indonesia. There was little point in doing this in 1944, though, since the last thing Dutchmen in Japanese prisoner of war camps in Batavia wanted to hear was German Nazi propaganda beamed out of occupied Hilversum. The programme schedule indicates English programmes were on the air too, but no scripts survive of what was actually said. In May 1943, the Germans decided they would confiscate radios in the Netherlands to drastically reduce listening to shortwave broadcasts by the Allies. Despite groundwave jamming in the cities here, signals from London were still getting through well enough for some people to hear the messages and run underground newspapers. But here's a paradox. Although it was forbidden to own a radio, there were electronic hobby magazines in circulation well after May 1943, when the Germans ordered people to give in their radio sets. Before the war, shortwave reception on many receivers was simply a gimmick. Simple sets for medium wave were often of the cheap, tuned radio frequency design. They were fine on medium wave, but not the most sensitive on shortwave. The super heterodyne concept for better shortwave reception appeared in the mid-30s in the Netherlands. The radios were far more stable, sensitive and selective, and also very expensive. A super het design was well beyond the price range for most people. Two Dutch hobby magazines were published until November 1943. Radio Express and Radio Bulletin encouraged people to construct radios out of spare parts. Looking through the issues, you can find circuit diagrams for complete super heterodyne receivers. And there were also designs for what the Dutch called a voorzet apparaat. This was a simple frequency converter. You connected an aerial to this home-constructed box and put it next to a simple medium-wave radio. Shortwave signals were tuned in on the converter, but listened into on the medium-wave radio tuned to a fixed frequency. In some of the darkest moments in the war, in late 1943, the magazines warned constructors that super-heterodyne receivers needed to be carefully screened. If not, the oscillator valve inside the radio acted as a small transmitter and could be detected by anyone within a 100-meter radius. That could mean a German radio control service. To cap it all, both Radio Express and Radio Bulletin carried articles with instructions on how to make short and medium wave loops.
Hier, Radio Oranje, de stem van strijdend Nederland, op golflengte 1500...
Veteran broadcaster Fritz Tors was a regular voice on Dutch domestic radio from 1926 to 79. He recalls how he continued to listen to Radio Orange, or Radio Oranje, at 8:15 each evening, long after the radio ban of May 1943.
You are not supposed to have a radio set unless you were of the party or connected with broadcasting. Then I was lucky enough to have a small set, my old shortwave set, as a matter of fact, and I put that together at 8:15 or just before 8:15. In one cupboard I had my valves, in the other cupboard I had the coils, and so I put it together so that they never could find a complete set if they wanted to look for it. And so we listened to Radio Orange, we listened to BBC Dutch, we listened to the BBC Home Service, we tried to listen as much as we could.
Arno Veltens of the Dutch Broadcasting Museum in Hilversum explains that as soon as the southern part of the Netherlands was liberated, during the last quarter of 1944, some of the broadcasters who'd been working in London started a liberation operation designed to reach listeners in occupied Holland. When he founded the station, Henk van den Broek had no idea liberation of the north would take until May 1945.
Yeah, that's true. Henk van den Broek was the person to do so, because he started already in 1940 a free radio station for a couple of days in France, because it wasn't occupied then. Then he fled to England. He worked for De Brandaris, he worked for Radio Orange, and later on he became the man from Herreizend Nederland.
People of Radio Oranje, at the liberation of the southern part of Holland, they started their rising, how to translate it, Herreizend Nederland, the re-rising Netherlands, or resurging Netherlands, I don't know how you would call it, but that was the first station on free Dutch soil. And they started at Eindhoven on the 3rd of October 1944.
Tors recalls working for Van den Broek soon afterwards. Radio Herreizend Nederland wouldn't have started so early had it not been for the courageous work of C.A. Gerels, an engineer at Philips Research Laboratories, who led a small team. They built and hid a fully operational medium-wave transmitter tuned to 430 metres. However, Gerels was later arrested for other resistance work and died in a Nazi concentration camp in March of 1945. On May the 5th, the German General Blaskowitz surrendered his forces in Holland to the Canadian General Fox at a hotel in Wageningen. A recording of the ceremony was broadcast shortly afterwards by Radio Horizon Nederland.
The German commander agrees to surrender of all German forces in Holland, in northwest Germany, including the Frisian Islands, Heligoland, all other islands in the Schleswig-Holstein and in Denmark, to the Commander-in-Chief 21 Army Group. These forces to lay down their arms and to surrender unconditionally all hostilities on sea or in the air by the German forces in the above areas to cease 4800 hours British double summer time, Saturday, the 5th of May, 1945.
Veldmaarschalk Montgomery heeft aan generaal Eisenhower medegedeeld.
But as Radio Horizon Nederland broadcast the news, there were still attempts to confuse. During the war, the Dutchman Max Blokzijl had broadcast political talks on behalf of the Nazis. Even on the day of capitulation, his voice was monitored over an emergency transmitter, Radio Festung Holland.
Ik wil ook niet zeggen dat er een capitulatie tot stand is gekomen. Een en ander geldt zeer in het bijzonder ook voor de Festung Holland.
Blokzijl claimed there'd simply been a ceasefire and that German troops were still in control. Yet on May the 9th, the regional network in Flensburg, Germany, came on the air with its last message from the German High Command.
Land is 4:03. Reichssender Flensburg and the angesprochenen Sender.
Meanwhile, Radio Horizon Nederland planned to move north under van den Broek's command.
He became the head of the subsection radio of the military government which we had at the moment. And he was in charge of Horizon Nederland. He was the boss in Eindhoven first, and after the end of June 1944, we went to Hilversum and we broadcast from the existing Hilversum studios.
They had to be repaired because a lot of the broadcast equipment had been stolen or damaged.
Unfortunately, well, Hilversum isn't used anymore. We just call them Radio 1, 2, 3, 4. Fretful.
You had the Radio Horizon Nederland. Yes. When did Holland feel it was important then to go back onto shortwave because the transmitter of PCJJ in Huizen had been destroyed?
PCJJ had been destroyed, and one of the first things of the Horizon Nederland people was to restore broadcasting to the East Indies, especially because there were still Dutchmen in those old Japanese camps. They couldn't get to Holland, and they, of course, were very anxious to know about their family in Holland. So that was one of the first priorities, to reopen on shortwave, especially for the East Indies.
When did that happen?
On the 13th of October, 1945, I remember that well.
What did you have to do?
I had to direct the show. I had to make the announcement. I had to read part of the news. And, well, that was, as a matter of fact, our first link with the Dutchmen waiting for their repatriation in the Jap camps. And we got some very nice letters after that, and people who heard Holland for the first time.
Fritz Thor's letter work for the Dutch services of the BBC and Radio Canada International, as well as running the foreign language departments of Radio Netherlands for 8 years. Van den Broek became the first director of Radio Netherlands. He hoped, though, that a single organisation would remain for domestic broadcasting too.
But his ideas of a national broadcast like BBC, they didn't approve of it. The forces of the old broadcasting companies were too severe and too strong.
It's interesting, in fact, the discussion about a national broadcasting organization for the public sector is in fact taking place right now.
Yeah, that's true.
It was also traditional at that time to put the name of the radio station on the dial. In fact, some people can actually say when a radio was built by the names and the wavelengths that are marked on the dial. Do you find that, though, with Radio Horizon Nederland? Did that last long enough that people actually put it on the radio?
Yeah, there were only a few models made by it. For instance, we have an NSF receiver of a certain type from 1945, which has Radio Horizon Nederland on the schedule.
And for the next few days, Radio Netherlands is reviving the theme tune used in the 1940s.
Dit is Netwerk Europa op de Korte Golf. Zenders in heel Europa. Radio Nederland. Wereldomroep.
Back to the present, Diana.
Well, Jonathan, whenever there is an event to be celebrated, you can count on a group of radio amateurs to create a ham radio station with a special call sign. The celebrations concerning Liberation Day are no exception, and as we hinted last week, an amateur radio station in Eindhoven is operating as we're on the air right now. The station, PA6RHN, went on the air at midnight, May the 4th, and will continue until noon this coming Sunday, May the 7th. The project coordinator is Maarten Dommering, and we asked him to outline the significance of the call.
We have a special call sign, which is Papa Alpha 6 Romeo Hotel November, which stands for Radio Horizon Nederland.
But why are you doing this?
We all are interested in what happened during the Second World War, and we were... brought up in with a certain amount of respect for things that happened in those days. Secondly, we all are radio amateurs, and we are interested in old equipment, tube equipment, so to speak.
So the transmissions at the moment are coming from Eindhoven, that's in the south of the Netherlands. But where about exactly?
Well, that's the amazing thing about this. We tried to get the original building, but that was torn down a few years ago. Then we tried to get some other building that is owned by the Philips company. But that didn't work out either. And then we had a phone call with the mayor of Eindhoven. And he arranged the police headquarters for us. Well, that is a nice place to have the aerials, because they have a flat roof, which is about the size of a soccer field. So plenty of space to put the aerials there.
But there is a radio connection, because although you're not on exactly the same spot as the original transmitter of Radio Reizen Nederland operational 50 years ago, you're about one wavelength away, is that right?
Yeah, that's how we put it. It's about one wavelength on 80 meters, because the original building was the Philips Ontspanningscentrum, and that's very close to where the police headquarters is nowadays.
So that translates as the recreation center, I suppose. Now to some details if you want to try and listen out for this special amateur radio station, PA6RHN. Martin, if people have a receiver capable of single sideband reception, what frequencies will you be using when people try after this edition of Media Network has gone off the air?
We will be using on 80 meters 3575 CW, 3715 in AM, full AM, 3775 on SSB. Then for long distance we will use 20 meters, 14200 SSB and AM. And then for local connections we will have 2 meters, 144.325 for SSB and 145.425 on FM.
I'll just repeat the most important frequencies again. 3575 uses Morse code, 3715 kilohertz is active in full AM, so you don't even need a special SSB receiver to demodulate that channel, and the rest are all in SSB. The channels are 3775 and 14200, plus or minus interference. So do tune around either side of those frequencies if you don't immediately hear them. Now, if you have a license, then contact the station in the usual way. The operators also are interested in reception reports from shortwave listeners. In that case, the address to write to is PA6RHN, PO Box 6222, postal code 5600, HE in Eindhoven. And once again, that's PA6RHN, PO Box 6222, postal code 5600, HE in Eindhoven, and Eindhoven is spelled as Eindhoven. Please enclose return postage in the form of an international reply coupon to defray the costs. This is, after all, a non-profit operation. Martin, I understand you'd especially like to speak to Dutchmen overseas, or perhaps people who have somehow been involved with the liberation of the Netherlands.
Yeah, we would like to happen that way. in this way they can, well, I wouldn't say revive or relive history, but they haven't got too many chances, I guess, to contact Dutch people. This might be a good solution for them.
That was Maarten Dommering on the line from Eindhoven.
Our Pacific media correspondent, Arthur Cushion, is not only a veteran broadcaster for this program on Radio Netherlands, he played an interesting role in New Zealand during the Second World War. Cushion wasn't accepted into the forces because of failing eyesight. He volunteered to monitor the radio at all hours of the night.
Right through that period, Jonathan, working for security at home, monitoring mainly Berlin and Italian, and over in the Pacific area, of course, Japan had stations in Saigon, Manila, Batavia, Singapore, Penang, those sort of areas. And, of course, my main interest was getting messages from prisoners and civilian internees, and also from the news about the South Pacific. But I think my biggest interest, in fact, is that a lot of these things which Berlin and Tokyo said actually did happen, but when you look at the results and the losses, I mean, that was all propaganda, but these actions often happened which were a forerunner to the Allied announcement that such and such a battle had taken place.
So what you're saying, that the facts were actually true, but they exaggerated about the losses on the enemy side?
That's right, yes. You know, any warship sunk, that was generally the case, but just how many were sunk at a certain time were debatable until the Allies gave some details of the particular battle.
And did you get any feedback from people that, as a result of your monitoring, you managed to reunite?
Yes, we had time delay, Jonathan, was with the civilian internees, Prince, in Singapore. That would be a couple of years before any information came out that they were alive. I've got great memories of local people, visiting local people, and telling them their son was a POW. And, of course, that cut down the long wait after they were posted missing until the Red Cross certified that they were in a POW camp. I can well remember a telegram from a woman who said, God bless you and a thousand thanks. Here ends worrying days and sleepless nights.
And how many people were there like yourself doing this sort of monitoring?
The New Zealand DX Club had a group and I was officer in charge, and we had various monitors from New Zealand, and we pulled the resources here, mainly because, of course, it was all written longhand and the reception varied. But Berlin had a program called Anzac Tattoo in which they featured POWs from this area, and we also had a bit from Lord Hawhor. And, of course, there were programs from Batavia which were directed to Australia and New Zealand during our lunch hour on 18155, which gave fairly reliable reception every day, and that contained news of Australian and New Zealand servicemen.
Because that was Batavia, now Jakarta, under Japanese occupation.
And that's the same with Radio Singapore, which they renamed Shonan. An interesting thing about Singapore, it was operated by the British Malayan Broadcasting Corporation, and when I wrote to the station after the war, they sent me the same old card but changed it out to British Occupation Forces. The cards had been there all those 6 years in the studio and no one had thought of throwing them out.
And how many messages did you process a day, roughly?
10 or 12. The Germans used to sandwich the messages in between the news items, a bit like a commercial. So you had to listen through all the news to get what you're looking for, the POW information.
Thanks, Arthur. More from him next week. We hear now from Chris Greenway at BBC Monitoring that Croatia has decided to increase its broadcast to the world to get Zagreb's side of the story more widely known.
Yes, there's been an expansion of broadcasts from Croatia, in particularly broadcasting in English. Up to now, their shortwave transmitters have been on the air 24 hours a day, but simply relaying the first programme of their domestic service, which is nearly all in the Croatian language, though there are a few short English language news bulletins at various times during the day. However, since the beginning of this week, since the 1st of May, we've been noting that in the overnight period, the shortwave transmitters have been breaking away from the domestic service to actually carry separate programming of a 10-minute news bulletin on the hour every hour in English. This offers opportunity for people in Europe and I should think North America as well to hear the news in English from Zagreb. The frequencies to tune into are 5895 and 7370. And we've observed this as early as before midnight GMT. The transmitters resume relaying the domestic service at 0500 GMT.
Okay, back to the past, because you've been delving into the archives, to the written archives, I guess.
That's right. The office that I work in, which is called the Foreign Media Unit of the BBC Monitoring Service, 50 years ago it was known as the Special Listening Section, and the publication that we produce each week now, World Broadcasting Information, was then known as Reception Notes. And obviously this week, 50 years ago, it's been extremely interesting to look at what they were hearing. Right up until the very last moments of the war, the Germans had managed to keep a number of radio stations on the air, although the coordination between them had broken down. By the end of April, in fact, of 1945, there was no longer a single nationwide radio service for listeners in Germany. There were three separate so-called home service stations, and of course it was quite a job for the people here to keep track of all these various changes. Transmitters were being slowly captured by the Allies or going off the air.
And what was reception like in general? Because we were nearly at the top of the sunspot cycle then.
Well, actually, this is something that struck me, was actually how well they were managing to do. I think one reason is probably just shows how much less cluttered the bands were in those days. Nearly all of these stations were on medium wave. The shortwave services ceased to exist just a little time before the end of the war. The main long-wave station, Deutschlandsender, had gone by the end of April, although another long-wave station came up from Flensburg at the beginning of May. But most of the stations they were listening to were on medium-wave, and it's actually quite interesting that they were able to listen to these in Hamburg, in Bremen, Munich, and some other parts of Germany right throughout the day.
Well, clutter on the dial makes that impossible now. Incidentally, WBI this week will include historical items from 50 years ago with wavelengths in good old metres. Radio Netherlands makes some slight frequency changes as from Sunday, May the 7th. At midnight 30 UTC, the morning service to Asia will start using 11655 and 9860 kilohertz. And at 0130 UTC, look for us on 9890 kilohertz as well. At 0730 UTC, check 9700 kHz for our service to the Pacific. We're dropping the channel in the 25-metre band. All that, of course, was planned in advance, and it's in our programme schedule on target. But there is one other change because of interference problems on one of the channels to North America. Joining me now is Rokus de Jeder from our Department for Distribution and Frequency Planning.
We think we have, according to all the monitoring reports we get, and also from your listeners, Jonathan, we have a rather serious problem with our 9840 kilohertz transmission. We have Radio Kuwait code channel. So the next thing we are planning to do is shift this transmission from Bonaire from 9840 kilohertz, 5 kilohertz up to 9845 kilohertz. And we'd like some reactions as soon as possible if this new transmission, 9845 kilohertz, is a better solution.
Right, that starts at 2330 UTC.
Yes.
And when does it actually go into effect?
Next Sunday, the 7th of May.
Meanwhile, in our programme schedule on target, we're talking about the Astra 1C satellite, the fact that we're going to use a subcarrier on there. If you listen to the subcarriers mentioned in the programme schedule, there's nothing there as yet. When are we planning to bring that on stream?
Well, my colleague John right now is at Betzdorf in Luxembourg at the uplink station of Astra, of SES, and he is right now installing a satellite reception dish. So we hope to start testing next week this new audio subcarrier on Astra.
So check at 2030 UTC on transponder 64, 10.936 gigahertz, audio subcarrier 7.74 megahertz, and you might hear us in English.
And that's all for the moment. I'm off for a few days in Madrid to practice my Spanish, so I think I'm guaranteed a sunny weekend. From Jonathan Marks and myself, thanks for listening today. And don't forget the other thematic programs going out this special week. And join us again, 7 days, for more from the world of wireless.
Hope from the South was a Radio Netherlands presentation. Copyright 1995.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.